Welcome to Refreshing Reflections. I'm Sean Scott, reading October 2019 issue of The Guidepost. I begin with the cover story, Being Harriet, by Cynthia Erivo, New York, New York. I stand on the bridge above the freezing, roaring river. I am out of options, the enemy closing in on me from each direction. The only way out is down, to jump into the swirling rapids below, the way to safety, to freedom, or to death. I look to the left, look to the right, and then do what I always do. I ask God for help, then I jump. Cut. I play abolitionist Harriet Tubman, a woman of great courage, strength, and faith in the movie Harriet. Taking on the role was a leap, in and of itself, a leap of faith. Most of us know the story. Harriet Tubman made multiple trips into slave-owning territory and brought out some 70 enslaved people on what was called the Underground Railroad, even though by doing so she could have been killed or returned to slavery herself. In the Civil War, she fought with the Union, the first American woman to lead a military expedition. She was celebrated for her valor. All of that can be found in the history books I read as a child growing up in England. My mother had immigrated there from Nigeria. What was really at the heart of Harriet Tubman's bravery? As an actor, you naturally study the character you're playing, read all you can about them. One reason I was cast was that I'm short like Harriet Tubman, a little over 5 feet. I'm also a fairly physical actor. She was strong, powerful. To play this part, I knew I would have to work out even harder than usual to be able to do what she did. Lots of trips to the gym. To really master a role, every actor tries to find a way into the character she's playing. To play Harriet, I had to understand faith at its most elemental level. To understand her faith and courage, I needed to probe my own faith and call on it. Harriet never did anything without listening to God for guidance, being present for the dangers she faced and present to what she could take her through them. I pray to God to make me strong and able to fight, she once said. And that's what I've always prayed for ever since. My faith is always with me. It was my mother who taught me how to pray. We prayed over dinner, and she heard my bedtime prayers. I also heard her pray in the shower and in the bathroom when she was getting dressed before work. She prayed out loud, talking to God as though he was right there in the room with her. There were no restrictions when it came to prayer. You could pray at any time and all times. God was with you. I realized that's exactly how Harriet survived, being in touch with God constantly. She could jump into that cold water because she prayed, River of peace, flow through me, Lord, help me through. She could rescue others, heeding her own safety and freedom because she believed God was always with her and for her. I would have to feel the same, to shoot scene after scene in frigid temperatures. I needed to be Harriet Tubman. Before I even left my house and got onto the set, I prayed, keep us safe, keep our bodies safe, keep our minds alive, and make the place safe for her to be in. Bring Harriet into this place, I asked God. I asked him to give me the strength to get through the day and tell the story as truthfully as I could, and to know that Harriet herself was watching over us. The obstacles to the film were huge. But then the obstacles Harriet faced in her life were far greater. She suffered terribly. As an adolescent, she came between a violent slave owner and another slave. The owner hurled a heavy metal weight at the slave, but it hit Harriet in the head, instead injuring her permanently. For the rest of her life, she suffered dizziness, pain, and seizures. During seizures that rattled her body, she would have visions. visions of God communicating to her. I had to be strong like her, but I also had to feel from the inside what it would be like to be a slave, to be subjugated and abused, to have seizures and visions, reenacting one. I felt wretched, raw, emotionally undone, super exposed, which I imagine is how Harriet felt. It must have been unbelievably hard, but sometimes going through an illness can open you up to things you wouldn't be able to do otherwise. In suffering, we also find a new closeness to God. There were two songs Harriet often used, according to historians, when she was sneaking into dangerous territory via the Underground Railroad. A fellow abolitionist had nicknamed her Moses, and naturally enough, she would sing "Go Down Moses" and "Bound for the Promised Land," bringing liberated slaves to a new promised land. Those spirituals became passwords, and she would change the cadence to let others know it was safe to come out in the middle of the night. Though she couldn't read or write, Harriet was savvy and wise. If she noticed someone trying to identify her on a train, she picked up a newspaper and pretended to read it. In a scene from the movie, a slave owner waves a wanted poster in her face. Isn't she this Moses? Shouldn't be arrested or put in jail? No, she coyly suggests. It couldn't be her. She's not at all the right height. She had been born Araminta Ross and called Minty. But when she found her way to freedom, she chose a new name. In the movie, we show that historic moment when at the Pennsylvania Society for the Abolition of Slavery, she tells William Steele, portrayed by actor Leslie Odom Jr., that she is Harriet Tubman. Tubman for her husband, who was still in Maryland. Harriet, in honor of her mom. Prayer was always with us on the shoot. We filmed in cold weather because Harriet often traveled in the wintertime. It was safer. People were more likely to be indoors, and she was less likely to be noticed. Facing the elements, I would prepare by singing to myself, listening to gospel music, Kim Burrell and Molly music, the way Harriet would sing to herself to stay connected to her faith. I also prayed with the other actors right on the set. In one scene, Harriet meets with Reverend Green, the actor Von D. Curtis Hall, and he prays for her upcoming journey. We were in the church. I was sitting opposite Von D., and we were two actors doing a scene. Yet the prayer was real and unrehearsed. It had to be. There was a day on the set when everything seemed to be going wrong. We were rushing around, and I didn't feel I truly had time to prepare for a scene we were about to do. That pivotal moment when Harriet walks across the Delaware border to freedom. Casey Lemons, our wonderful director, wanted to catch the sunrise, but the weather wasn't cooperating. It was cloudy and overcast. Rain started to fall. We'd never get the shot she wanted. Time was running out. Still, the cameras were rolling. We'd have to settle for less. We'd do what we could. What would Harriet Tubman have done? She would have called on God. She always called on God. She couldn't have done the heroic things she had done without that. As Harriet, as myself, as both of us, I said a prayer of my own. I stepped across the border. All at once, the clouds parted and this big, bright, yellow-orange sun came forth, shining in my eyes. There was even a rainbow. Then another one, a double rainbow. It was overwhelming. God speaking, Harriet speaking in unison. I looked around me and everyone was in tears. The camera crew, Casey, everyone. What you see in the movie is what really happened. No CGI. It was such an honor to portray her, but I couldn't have done it without my faith. Being Harriet meant being in God's continual presence. There were times I couldn't even separate myself from her. to know this woman who refused to let circumstances dictate her future, refused to cave to fear, who stood up to the evil of slavery. Guided by her faith, she changed the course of history. Playing this role changed my life too. The Substitute by Marilyn Delisle Stroob of Reed City, Michigan. I thought retirement would be a sort of non-stop holiday, but here I was Friday night dozing through a rerun of MASH with my husband Joe, the end of another uneventful day. An hour until bedtime. Sleep was usually the thing I look forward to most. My phone pinged, jolting me awake. A text from the principal of Trinity Lutheran School. Good news. Jim's getting his liver transplant. Awesome, I typed back. I'd done some occasional subbing for Jim Chassel's 7th, 8th grade class that past fall and winter when complications from a rare liver disease sidelined him. Ever since, I kept him and his young family in my prayers. The principal asked, could you take over his class till the end of the year? Wait, what? It was late March. There were 2 solid months of classes left. Maybe I wasn't thrilled with retirement, but no way was I going back to work full time, even temporarily. Before I could tell him I wasn't interested, he'd already sent me an email outlining the job. I studied the color-coded schedule. 2 other teachers would handle math and social studies. I'd teach everything else. Language arts, reading literature, science and vocabulary. He added if you could squeeze in a couple of art lessons each week, that would be great too. I reminded him I knew nothing about teaching junior high. I taught English composition at a university. That seemed a lifetime ago, before my husband was in a bike accident and suffered a traumatic brain injury, forcing me to retire to care for him. Joe was fully recovered now, but still I was used to teaching college students, not middle schoolers. Science? Art? I wouldn't even know where to begin. The principal needed an answer by Monday. I told him I'd think about it. I knew he was in a bind, if I was his choice. God, there must be someone else. I didn't used to be so negative. There was a time I would have jumped at something new to do. That's what I thought I would find in retirement, but a lot of my energy had been consumed by caregiving. Then in January, I turned 65. My hip ached. Winter felt as if it would never end. The schools here had already had 20 snow days. Almost every day, I needed a nap. I barely left the house except for going to church, the grocery, and picking up the grands after school occasionally. I felt ancient, as if life had passed me by. I spent the weekend telling myself all the reasons I couldn't teach, but Monday morning I woke with nothing to do, nothing to look forward to. It had never been like that when I was teaching. I remembered the excitement of connecting with my students and seeing the difference I was making. I already knew the 7th and 8th graders from my time subbing. They weren't awful. It couldn't be worse than sitting around the house all day. I texted the principal. Okay, here's hoping I don't completely derail their education. He responded with a laugh out loud emoji. I didn't have the heart to tell him I wasn't joking. My first day would be Monday, April 15th, the day of Jim's surgery. The night before, my stomach was in knots. Don't worry, Joe said. You know what you're doing. But did I? I hadn't had as much as made up a lesson plan in 7 years. I stayed up late reading and rereading the textbooks. I woke early the next morning to a ping from my phone. No school due to the snow. A reprieve. That evening came news that Jim's surgery had been a success. I reminded myself that's really why I was doing this. The next day, the kids greeted me warmly. I passed out fresh-baked brownies, just as I had when I'd subbed for them, and told them a bit about myself, how I'd taught college-level English for 8 years. Things went downhill in the days that followed. There were constant disruptions, the school was preparing for its annual operetta, and the 7th and 8th grade students all had major roles. I couldn't find my rhythm. The students were distracted. Then we got slammed by another ice storm. 3 more snow days. Another week of school was added to the schedule. The students hadn't even cracked their science textbooks. "I'm cutting the first half hour of silent reading time," I announced to the class, our first day back. "Also, afternoon recess. We have to get focused and make up for lost time." The class looked stunned. Then complaints started flying. "I can also shorten lunch period," I said. The room went silent. The kids glared at me. "I wish Mr. Chattel was back," I heard one boy, Nick, mutter. I ignored it. Though nearly every day with Nick the class clown had been difficult. "Let's talk about how to do proper sourcing for your research papers," I said. There were groans, but I plunged ahead, detailing how to effectively use direct quotes. After lunch, we finally got to science. The lecture I'd prepared weeks earlier and coral reefs, I could see their eyes glazing over. But what could I do? It was part of the curriculum. We ended the class reading from their vocab books and doing the exercise together. When the bell rang, they handed in their work and headed out, shoulders slumped. The kids hated me. I went to the school chapel to try to collect my thoughts. I should have never accepted this assignment. I wasn't the right fit, but it was too late to quit now. Lecturing wasn't going to cut it. I had to find some way to engage them. That evening, I baked brownies again. I put one on each student's desk in the morning, hoping for a fresh start. "I'm reinstating silent reading time," I said. "Then I'd like you to select a book we can read together for literature." They munched on their brownies, smiles all around. Then they dug through books in the lit boxes. They picked Bud, not Buddy, to read as a class. A book I'd secretly hoped they would choose, about an African-American boy growing up in Flint, Michigan during the Great Depression. We took turns reading the first chapter. The kids read loudly, confidently. We all laughed at how Bud got back at a mean boy at his orphanage. Then I had them write about what we had read, including direct quotes, the way I taught them. I'd never seen them so focused. The room silent, except for the sound of their pencils scratching in their journals. The next day, for science, I brought in a whole uncooked chicken. At first, the students watched as I cut through the layers, exposing the muscles, then opened up the chest cavity and showed them where the heart would be, cut open the sack of giblets and showed them the actual heart and liver, the gizzard. The children were fascinated. "Can we do it?" Nick asked. The very reaction I'd hoped for. "Yes," I said, "if you're very careful." I handed them blue surgical gloves I bought and let them take turns. One boy, Caden, focused on the tendons near the leg joint, talking about them as knowledgeably as if he were a doctor. "Where did you learn that?" I asked. "I hurt my knee playing football," he said. "I know a lot about foot tendons, too. But this chicken's missing his feet." Everyone laughed. It had been a great lesson, but there were still frustrations. A handful of students were flunking because they simply not turned in assignments. Every day, it seemed they came back later and later from lunch. They forgot to charge the Chromebook computers the school provided them. So when it was time to use them, the batteries were drained. It was as if they just didn't care. There were 3 weeks of school left, but with all the end-of-year activities, only 6 real days remained for the students to prepare for their final science exam. I'd already decided to make it open book, but it would still be challenging. There were so many concepts, they just didn't seem to grasp. One day at recess, I sat on a hill, watching the children play, what looked like a complicated game. "Come play with us," a girl named Anna yelled. "I don't know the rules," I yelled back with a shrug. "We'll teach you," Anna said. Let the kids teach. Could that actually work? I thought of Caden, how expertly he discussed chicken tendons. I'd already gone over every science lesson in detail with them. Maybe I didn't need to talk more. Maybe what they needed most was my encouragement. I jumped to my feet and jogged down the hill to join them. Funny how my hip wasn't aching so much anymore. The next day I ran my idea past the class. They looked at me quizzically. "Seriously?" one student said. For a moment I questioned myself. After all, their grades were riding on this. "Yes," I said, with all the conviction I could muster. "You know the information as well as I do. You just need to believe in yourselves." The first few lessons went well. Then it was Nick's turn. I doubted he'd ever heard a word I'd said for all his jokes and interruptions. "Are you ready?" I asked. Nick waggled his eyebrows, sending the class into giggle mode. I gave him my book and the answer guide. He strolled to the podium and wrote, "Mr. Nick," on the whiteboard. "Open your books to section 4.1 and get out your study guides," he said in a mock professorial voice. "But first, who is seen finding Nemo?" The class howled. I opened my mouth to shut him down, then noticed he wasn't laughing. "I'm serious," Nick said. "There's a scene in there about Dory and Nemo and the Endendarians. If you have trouble remembering them, just think of that scene. It's everything you need to know." "Okay, Ryan, please read the first paragraph." I couldn't believe it. Nick was a natural. The class hung on his every word. He'd gone 10 minutes over before I realized I'd forgotten to set the timer. At recess, I told him how impressed I'd been. "Have you ever thought about becoming a teacher?" I asked. "Not until today," he said shyly. "But I wouldn't want to teach kids like me. I'd teach college." I laughed, marveling at his words, at everything that had happened these past 2 months. The sense of accomplishment, as seeing a student grasp a concept, the connection with my class, the joy of doing meaningful work. I felt it all, stronger than ever before. Retirement would have to wait. God, I knew, had other plans for me. "Thanks, Mr. Nick," I said. "I'll be happy if I can learn to teach middle school like you." Never too late to serve. Looking for a way to serve your community after retirement, as Marilyn Delisle Stroob does? We talked to Kristen Fox, Director of Senior Companions of South Dakota, whose grant is sponsored by the Good Samaritan Society, about how seniors can make a difference in other lives through Senior Corps programs. What is Senior Corps? It's a nationwide network of service programs for people 55 and older. Through its three main programs, Senior Companions, Foster Grandparents, and RSVP, volunteers address needs and improve lives in their communities. Find out more at nationalservice.gov. How do Senior Corps volunteers make a difference? Senior Companions offer friendship and help with daily tasks to older adults, allowing them to live independently. Our companions take clients to the grocery, doctor's appointments, the salon, Fox says. Some volunteers do light housekeeping and meal prep. Others provide respite care so family caregivers can take a break. Perhaps the most important thing they offer is companionship. Foster grandparents work with kids in high-need schools. They do one-on-one tutoring and mentor struggling teens. RSVP volunteers serve in a variety of ways. They might help veterans find jobs or rebuild after natural disasters. For example, how do volunteers benefit from their service? In a new study, Senior Corps volunteering reported improved health and significantly less depression and isolation after 2 years of service. Our volunteers feel they get more than they give, Fox says. Getting up every morning with a sense of purpose is so important. They get the satisfaction of helping someone. Senior companions and their clients quickly become friends, and we've had some pairing for years. Senior companions and foster grandparents who meet income eligibility guidelines receive a modest tax-free stipend, plus reimbursement for mileage and other costs. What makes a good volunteer? Our senior companions love to talk, Fox says. They're also good listeners and able to relate to people from different backgrounds. They care deeply about helping others. That's more important than any particular skill. Where can seniors find other opportunities to serve? Search volunteermatch.org for options in your area. Figure out what interests you, then call up relevant nonprofits and ask how you can help. Fox suggests check with your local volunteer center, library, or community center. Free smiles. I work in a hospital. At my orientation, all the new employees watched an empathy film so we'd be aware of what patients and their families might go through. Worries over paying for treatment, saying goodbye to a loved one for the last time. A little kindness can make all the difference to a person. Since then, I make sure to smile and say hello to everyone. At first, it was just people at the hospital. Patients, co-workers, visitors to brighten potentially bad days. It felt great when people smiled back, but I never took it personally if they didn't. Now, I smile at people everywhere I go. At cashiers and fellow shoppers at the grocery. At the movie theater. I hope that seeing for a moment that someone cares helps strangers deal with the difficult situations in their life. Best of all, smiling is free. Why don't you give it a try? Lori Radonsi, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Well, we are out of time, but I would like to leave you with a quote by Anne Voskamp. In stressful times, seek God. In painful times, praise God. In terrible times, trust God. And at all times, thank God. Thank you for listening. I'm Sean Scott, and until next time, may we all be refreshed.